There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Shares for beginners.
Phil Muscatello and FinPods are authorized reps of MoneySherpa. The information in this podcast is general in nature and doesn't take into account your personal situation.
The problem with the coin silage approach is it's often used by scoundrels in the industry to justify any crappy investment that they want to sell, because it creates the illusion that this is side money, you can do something about it.
G'day and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Muscatello. What is a high-risk asset and what does it mean for your long-term returns? Can you incorporate high-growth investment options and still sleep at night? But as I've just been finding out talking before we roll tape, is that I've got this completely arse up. G'day, Vince Scully, Chief Sherpa at Life Sherpa. Welcome back to the podcast.
G'day, Phil. It's great to be back.
What we're going to be talking about is high growth. And as you pointed out before we went on air, because you wanted to correct my version of events with high growth, is that I was thinking about approaching this episode about high growth assets and the particular companies on the share market were considered high growth. But this is not the case, is it? There's much more subtlety and nuance. I know you like going into the weeds, Vince.
Yeah, well, as you know, nuance is the first casualty of the internet. So
and finance.
And so it's not so much wrong as there are different meanings applied to the word growth or high growth in different contexts.
And just let's get back, because this is another thing that you'll be looking at in your super statement, and you'll see terms like growth, aggressive, and so forth. So we're kind of trying to dig down into this particular aspect of it so that listeners actually know what they're talking about when they say that.
That's right, what their super fund's talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when we talk about growth, in its generic sense, it just means the value of your assets going up. In a categorization sense, we divide assets into growth assets or defensive assets. And growth assets are ones that are generally capable of growing faster than inflation. And they're generally bricks or businesses, or bricks, infrastructure and real estate, businesses, shares, as contrasted with defensive assets being the other three Bs, being bank bills, cash, bonds, which are really IOUs from governments and companies, and bullion, which I needed a B word that reflected commodities, but for most people that means gold, which is why I use the word bullion. So
hasn't gold been on a tear lately?
It has. In fact, for more than 20 years, really. I mean, that's part of its attraction, that if you look at what happened in 2008, when the stock market fell 40%, well, gold was up 20 or 30. Similar thing happened during the COVID collapse, although that was much more short-lived. So that's, I guess, growth assets and defensive assets.
Yep.
Within the growth category, or specifically within the businesses portion, the shares portion, we describe some shares as being growth shares or growth companies, which are companies that the market expects their future earnings to grow quickly. And the obvious ones are things like Google, Facebook, Amazon. And so that means they are generally priced on a high multiple of today's earnings because tomorrow's earnings are expected to be higher. So they are referred to as growth assets, growth companies, and they as distinct to, say, value companies. And they tend to underperform over time because you're paying more for the same cash flow today. So they include more price risk. Now, for a while, they will generally deliver higher growth. So that's what we've seen with the big seven recently. Facebook, Amazon, Google, all have been growing into those earnings. Where the problem lies is when that growth starts to level off, which it always will. And so that's why value shares tend to, over the longer term, deliver better returns because you're buying the cash flow at a lower multiple.
They're also companies that you would expect to deliver higher growth because they're higher risk. So generally smaller companies. So smaller companies, you know, it's much easier to double the revenue of a company that's making $10 million in revenue than one that's making $1 billion in revenue. And so they can grow more quickly. They tend to have less analyst attention, so there's more scope for a manager to outperform. And so allocating some money to smaller companies, and in an Australia context, that's generally stuff that's outside the ASX 300 and can deliver you higher returns. And then finally, the way you put those all together into a portfolio can create a growth portfolio or a high growth portfolio or a balanced or a conservative or a capital stable portfolio. So in that context, these words don't necessarily mean anything. There's no legal definition of what a growth portfolio or a high growth portfolio is. But as a general rule, you know, anything that's more than about 85% growth assets would generally be referred to as a high growth portfolio. I have seen portfolios described as balanced from some of our leading super funds with asset allocations in that range. But as a general rule of thumb, you should think about an 85% plus as being high growth.
So it's a factor of the allocation then, because I came in thinking there are particular assets, like if you look at small caps, they are high growth assets. Yeah. And this might be a common misconception amongst people.
Yeah, I mean,
people.
It's just people use the same words to describe different things. So it's always a good question to think about when someone uses these words is, well, what do they mean? Do they mean high growth assets? Do they mean a high growth portfolio? Do they mean a high growth company? And all of those things mean different things and have different implications for your investing.
And it makes sense to ask or refer to them in those kind of terms.
You could use the same word three different ways in the same sentence and still make sort of sense. So it's important to always think about what's the context of that word. And when anyone talks about, you know, my portfolio did well or this asset did well, you've always got to ask, compared to what? And is that compared to what? An asset with similar sort of risk characteristics. That you can always have a higher expected return by taking more risk. So when people say you can't beat the market, well, that's true depending on how you define the market. But if I take a well-selected portfolio of small companies, that is companies that are outside the ASX 300, I would expect that over time they will outperform the ASX 300.
If they survive.
If they survive. Mm. So, you know, I said well-selected is the important point, that there is no tradable index that you can buy that looks at the X 300 in any meaningful sense. Yeah, the all odds includes, I think it's 1800, but the ones that are, you know, 301 to 1800 are largely a rounding difference when compared to the 300. Just as the 300, you know, the 201 to 300.
They're pretty small companies, aren't they? Yeah. Well, in comparison. No, I mean,
they're certainly small compared to BHP and NAB, but they're still, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in market cap. So, but I guess the point I was trying to make, however inarticulately, was that 201 to 300 makes stuff all difference when you compare it to the 200. So ASX 200 versus ASX 300, substantially the same. And to get that benefit of small caps, you need to look beyond the 300.
Mm. So risk and its related volatility, that's meat and potatoes for you financial planning types.
Yeah.
And this is, when you're looking at companies, assets that are going to grow faster, there is going to be inherent levels of risk. This is really volatility.
Yeah.
And there's ways of measuring this, isn't there?
There is. And it's important to understand what we mean when we use volatility as a proxy for risk.
It still blows me away that that they're so interchangeable in financial terms. I never realized until...
Yeah. And it's probably unfortunate that that's what we do. But when most people start in investing, they think about risk as, will this company go bust?
Yeah, will I lose all my money?
Will I lose all my money?
Mm.
And
When you move beyond individual companies, that becomes a largely immaterial risk that, sure, companies in the ASX 200 go bust from time to time. You know, if you've been around as long as I have, so you go back to pre-GFC, we had companies like Alco, Babcock & Brown, ABC Childcare, you know, lots of companies that
OneTel.
I mean, Harris Scarf, the list is long, but looked at in the context of the overall ASX 200, those companies disappearing aren't going to leave you eating cat food in your retirement. So once you move away from individual companies, the concept of the bankruptcy risk or the total loss of my money becomes largely academic. And so when you're trying to say, is investing in the big four banks different to investing in the big three miners or the big two grocery retailers? One way of looking at that is, how wiggly is their share price? And that's really a measure of, you know, how much your portfolio, your investment is going to go up and down every day. And so the bigger the level of wiggliness or volatility, the greater the uncertainty of what your portfolio will be worth on any given day.
That's the risk.
And that's the risk, really. There are people who will say volatility is not risk. And that's true in the context of the bankruptcy risk. But in the context of what most people are trying to achieve, that is, we're all investing for some goal, right? We don't just invest, because to invest means we have to defer today's spending. So why are we doing that? We're doing that to achieve some goal in the future, whether that's tomorrow or next week or next year or next decade. And volatility drives the level of certainty you can have in what that outcome will look like when you want to achieve that goal. And that's what matters to most people. The argument that people put that volatility is not risk is that it only turns into a loss when you actually sell. And that's true. So in that sense, the value of your portfolio today compared to its value yesterday is relatively unimportant, other than the psychological impact it has on your behavior. What matters is, what's it going to be worth in whatever time frame I want to achieve this goal? And that is, will require you to take risk sufficient to deliver a return in excess of inflation to achieve that goal. And there are really three levers you can pull when it comes to achieving a goal. You've got time. So how long have you got? The longer you've got, the longer your money's got to work, the longer time it's got to grow, which is the benefit of compound interest or compound returns. You've got how much you're prepared to set aside. And we all have finite financial resources. So how much I set aside means I spend less today. And so there is a trade-off between what future Phil spends and what present day Phil spends. And there's a willingness to make that trade-off. And having set those two levers, the third lever then is return. So the longer you have and the more you set aside, the lower the return you need to achieve the same goal. And obviously there's a finite range of possible returns. And from a practical perspective, you know, a balanced portfolio that is something that's got between, say, 50 and 75% growth assets should be delivering you 8%. So inflation plus 5 or 6 probably. As you move up the risk curve, you might expect to get more than that. But to plan on getting more than 10% over the long term is increasing the probability that you won't achieve it. And that's the challenge. So if you look at the numbers, you know, the Australian share market has delivered an average return of 13% over the last 124 years. But an investor investing on the 1st of January 1900, just not and keeping their hands off it, would have realized 10% over that period before tax, before fees. And that's because a decline of 20% takes more than an increase of 20% to get back to where it was. So that's the...
And so on that particular date, it was very high and then it dropped afterwards?
No, it's just that if you take, let's say you've got a market that does plus 10, minus 10, average zero. But what would you actually got? You got 100 plus 10 is 110, minus 10% is 99. So you may have had an average return of zero, but you've now got a realized return of minus one. And it's just the maths that the bigger the number, the bigger the impact the percentage has.
That damn maths.
Yes. So that's the thing. The other place that volatility becomes important is your ability to stay the course. And when we see volatility, that is, or at least the negative bits of volatility, nobody cares about volatility going up. People care about, well, what happens when the volatility leads to a down period. And so faced with a 30%, 40%, 50% decline in the portfolio, many people will rush to hit the sell button. And that's the worst thing you can do. So by aligning your volatility with your tolerance and capacity for risk, you reduce the risk that you'll hit the sell button at an inopportune time and increase your ability to stay the course. And that's why volatility matters. You can't have return without volatility, but too much will lead to the sell. So you need enough growth to deliver the return you need, but enough defensiveness to allow you to sleep at night and keep your hand off the sell button. And that's partly where an advisor comes in. So by having a human between you and the market can help talk you down off the ledge in those periods. And, you know, many people under 40 whose, you know, experience of investing is the last 14 or 15 years have never really experienced a serious downturn. And so it can be tempting to believe that, you know, if some is good, more must be better, and therefore I should be going 100% growth or 100% equities within my 100% growth. And that looked great for the last 14 years, but over time, it's not looked that good. And history is littered with people hitting the sell button when they really needed to grit their teeth. And so by living through possibly the greatest real bull market, that is returns adjusted for inflation, the last 14 years have probably been the best 14 years in history. They won't turn up in the top 14 years of overall returns, but we've had a remarkably benign inflation position. We've had very low interest rates for that period. So those returns, you know, not only do they feel good because it's a big number, but they're also actually really good in real spending power adjusted terms. And there haven't really been that many big downturns. The COVID one might have been, you know, relatively deep as they come, but it was sort of all over in 4 or 5 months. And so it's important to understand your real tolerance for risk.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Super is one of the most important investments you'll ever make. But how do you know if you're in the best fund for your situation? Head to lifesherpa.com.au to find out more. Life Sherpa, Australia's most affordable online financial advice.
And also understand the timeline as well. Yeah. It's like if you're saving for a deposit on a house, you don't want to have your assets or have your dosh in assets that are going to be possibly get into a downturn.
Yeah, that's right. So if you're saving for your goal is 1 or 2 years out, you probably have no business being in the equity market.
Yeah, and that's what so many people say. You say, well, what's your goal? What do you want to do? And they say, I want to make as much money as possible. Yeah. And that's, you know, you've really got to talk people down from that position, don't
yeah.
you?
And then that whole concept of, which is sort of a natural human instinct, that I want to beat the market. So as a goal, that's a remarkably difficult thing to tie down. So if someone comes into me and says, look, what's your goal? Oh, I want to beat the market. Well, first of all, you've got to define the market. Do you mean the Australian market? Do you mean the equities market? Do you mean the residential property market? Do you mean big companies? Do you mean small companies? Do you mean value companies? Do you mean the ASX 200? Do you mean the S&P 500? What do you mean? And what currency are you going to measure it in? And are you going to measure it before or after taxes? And you also need to be comfortable that if the market's down 30%, is being down 25% going to feel like you've achieved your goal? That's what you've told me. I want to beat the market. But that actually bears very little relationship to why are you stopping present-day Phil spend this money in order for future Phil to be able to spend something more or different. And that return does matter. So when you look at retirement saving, about two-thirds of the money you spend in retirement comes from the earnings on your money and only a third from the money you put in. So return does matter, but you know, what I would say that my job as an advisor is to ensure that the return the market delivers, which I don't control, I have no better knowledge of what the ASX 200 is going to do tomorrow than you do, or my 20-year-old, 24-year-old son knows. But what I can do is help you construct a portfolio that you're going to be comfortable with, and I can make sure that those returns end up in your pocket. And we know from all of the research, and you know, any of your listeners want to look at the Dalbar research. Dalbar is a researcher in the US, and they produce a comparison between the returns of the market and returns of investors. And every time they do this, investors generally earn 3 to 5% less than the market they invest in or the funds they invest in. And that's because human nature makes us feel more bullish about investing when markets are heading up, and so we invest more money, and therefore we're buying in at higher prices, and people put less in when markets are falling because it doesn't feel very good. And that means that we tend to buy high, sell low, rather than what you actually want to do, which is buy low, sell high. And that avoiding that human behavior, again, is one of those important roles that advisors play in all of this. But, you know, I'm certainly not delusional enough to think that I control what the ASX 200 does.
Not going to make it go up.
That's right. Your Vanguard Australian Share Fund doesn't know whether you picked it by throwing a dart at the Fin Review, or you paid an advisor to do it, or you bought it because someone on Reddit said it was a good thing. It will do what it does, and nobody knows what it will do tomorrow. And what you need to do is tilt those odds in your favour by having the right mix of assets or asset classes and knowing that diversification is your friend, consistency is your friend, and low fees, all other things being equal, is your friend, and low taxes is your friend. So putting all that together and managing your own behaviour is the key to making this work.
What would you suggest? You know, because people often would like to have a little bit of what they call a punt on the side. Okay, they might be following those precepts religiously for 95% of their portfolio. But, you know, they want to have that little... Would you discourage someone from...
Yeah, I mean, this is the...
Is there a percentage that you would say, don't go over that percentage for your punting behaviour?
I mean, this is the concept of what is often referred to as core and satellite investing, that the core of your investments should be in diversified, low-cost, broad-based index funds with enough active funds playing their part where that sector is one that active management adds value. And then around that, you can have your, you know, whether you want to punt on crypto or...
Lithium.
Whatever.
Vanadium.
Whatever the thing
Vanadium's the latest thing.
That scratches your urge to do something. And as humans, we really like doing stuff. There's nothing as frustrating as having to sit back and keep your hands off things. And so having an active allocation to things that you feel passionate about can really build engagement and help protect your core, or your fortress, as I call it, that you want to lock this up. the core up so that it delivers your core return, and then you can have fun with the bit around it. Now, how big should that be? That's the challenge. For me, my TAB account is my satellite. So I am under no illusions that I know who's going to win race five at Randwick on the weekend. But boy, do I have fun playing with it. And that's, you know, the bit that we're... If your plan is to get some fun out of this money that you're setting aside for future Phil, how are you going to scratch that itch? For some people, it's investing in thematic funds. For some people, it's throwing the money at Cathie Woods. And some of it is crypto or whatever. And sometimes you'll make out like a bandit. Sometimes I hit the 100-to-1 roughy, but more often I don't. And what's the slogan these days? You know, you win some, you lose more. But that's not why I'm playing the TAB. This is about having fun.
Yeah, whereas many people approach the TAB or Neds or Ladbrokes as they're going to make some money. Yeah.
I mean, I worked with an actuary at Macquarie in the 90s, and we'd be in the office on a Saturday. I mean, this predates a lot of online betting, but he had his TAB accounts at the various TABs around the country and was playing off the odds of one against the other very successfully.
Mm.
But that was A, because he understood horses, and B, he was an actuary, so he was able to factor these odds in his head.
So he was arbitraging between TABs.
He was arbitraging
TABs.
The TABs.
Wow. Incredible.
So that's, to me, that satellite approach. The problem with the core and satellite approach, it's often used by scoundrels in the industry to justify any crappy investment that they want to sell.
Yeah.
Because it creates the illusion that this is side money, you can do something about it.
Speaking of investments and marketing of investments.
Well, that's what this podcast is about, Phil, isn't it?
Well, but trying to, you know, dig a bit deeper to what they're saying. I saw this ad on a bus shelter on the way walking up here, and it said, it was for a property trust, I think. I can't remember the name. And it said, active investment for the price of passive. It's such a meaningless...
What does it mean?
That's right. I mean, we sort of know what they're trying to say, but...
Yeah. Investment costs are, in general, coming down. You know, they've come down very materially over the last few decades.
Mm.
And
due to ETFs, competition, and so forth.
Access.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I
people starting to understand the fees that are involved.
Yeah. So when I started investing in London in the 80s, the standard way of getting was either you bought a managed fund directly from the manager and you filled out a form and pinned a check to it and stuck it in the mail, or you bought generally listed investment trusts or listed investment companies, generally trusts in the UK, which are sort of the equivalent of our LICs, and you paid a government-regulated brokerage to buy, which was typically, I think, 1% with a minimum of £100 or something. So these were material costs, and it was relatively inconvenient to do. The upside was your broker phoned you in the morning and said, Japan's looking good today, how would you buy some? The downside was that trading cost a lot of money. And that's why we all got into dividend reinvestment plans, because A, you got a discount for them, and B, you saved this massive brokerage. But the world's a different place today. You know, I can trade for close to zero, and I can practically go and buy a $1,000 parcel on my phone on the bus on the way to work.
Of any index you want.
And I can sell it by lunchtime. Well, not quite. You still have to have, we're still at T+2. That is, you don't get your stuff for 2 days after you buy it. But you know, that changes the dynamic on a lot of those things. So, but you've got to look at what does that do for your behavior. So if you can look at the market on your phone five times a day, you'll get a very different view of the world than if you look at it once a week or once a month.
Yeah, long-term investors looking at five-minute charts.
That's right. And as a general trend, the market goes up three-quarters of the time. The market, in that case, I mean equities markets, generally three-quarters of the time they go up, quarter of the time
they're designed to go up,
And that's largely because GDP goes up, inflation goes up, money supply goes up. So the number will go up over time. As my good friend Nick Murray says, the decline is temporary, the advance is inevitable. And the more you look at it, the more likely you are to see a down result. And the human brain's reaction to a negative news is twice as bad as our reaction to a positive news. So just do the maths, you know, three quarters you're going to get one, quarter time you're going to get two. So the more often you look, the more likely you are to get a down number. So if you're investing for the long term, don't check it in the short every day or every hour.
Vince, to finish off, have you shopped at Woolies lately and have you felt gouged?
The thing that does...
Oh, Coles, sorry. I should.
No, I am a Woolies shopper because I have two very close by. I think one was an old Franklin shop. And incidentally, the building that Woolies Neutral Bay occupies is actually owned by Coles. And I think there is...
Gee, talk about a cosy duopoly.
But the thing that really does bother me is Woolies have this scheme. I think it's called Everyday Rewards. I might have the brand name wrong. But they have two prices on a lot of products that if you're a member of this scheme, you get the lower price. And if you're not, you pay the higher price. So that's the incentive to hand over your email address so that
and
they know
what you're... Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of what tipped me over. I'm a very bad shopper. I do a just-in-time shop. I happen to walk by the door of Woolies on my way home from work. And so I usually pick up as much as I can carry from there to my house. And I only do the big heavy shop once a month. So I'm probably not your typical grocery buyer. But, you know, in Australia, the two grocers, I don't know what the share of the market, but it's probably 60 or 70%. We have four banks that have 80-plus percent of the market. We have two airlines that have most of the market. And that's just a consequence of living in a country that's thousands of miles from anywhere and has only got 29,000 people.
29 million.
29 million people, sorry.
Otherwise, we'd know everyone.
That's right. Sometimes it feels like we do. And that's just, that's life. Are they gouging? I think the suppliers are probably bearing them. But I think as consumers, we do okay. But it is interesting that the UK consumer has a much greater level of trust in their supermarkets than we do. They don't trust their banks. We trust our banks more than they do. So when you look at the UK consumer is quite happy to buy a bottle of wine with a Sainsbury's or a Tesco label on it. The Australian consumer won't. I mean, we do because, you know, if you look behind the brand, the address will be Coles or Woolies address, but they will never put a Coles or Woolies logo on it because we don't trust our supermarkets like they do. So
even if they marketed discount Goonies or?
No. I mean, that's why Aldi, when Aldi started selling grog in Australia, their advertising campaign was don't knock it till you try it. And they do have some absolute winners.
They do. I mean, that rosé. Huh.
I don't know about the rosé, but their El Toro Macho is, yeah, for $5.99 is...
It's a Tempranillo, isn't it?
It's a Tempranillo.
Tempranillo
yeah. From Spain. And for $5.99 on a weeknight, that is the bargain of the century. So that's my view on grocery stores.
And the gouging you can avoid if you think that you're getting gouged, you can go somewhere else anyway.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I do buy my coffee at Harris Farms.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got better things to do with my life than worry about whether I'm paying 5 cents more for my baked beans.
Vince Scully, thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. Been a blast.
Thanks for listening to Shares for Beginners. You can find more at sharesforbeginners.com. If you enjoy listening, please take a moment to rate or review in your podcast player or tell a friend who might want to learn more about investing for their future.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.